Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang. A new book details America's G.I. General, a full biography of General Omar Nelson Bradley. Award-winning author, military historian, leadership development expert, and former Wall Street executive Steve Osad joins us today on the Not Old Better Show.
Omar Bradley is remembered now mostly as the great tactical commander in the Western theater during World War II, and the most important American Army Group commander in that theater, with more than 1.3 million men under his command on VE Day. But perhaps more important is his role in the post-war world between 1945 and 1952, when, as a principal advisor and partner to Harry Truman, he shaped not only the VA, of which he was the first post-war administrator, but also the office of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, during which he faced his greatest challenge, the Korean War.
That, of course, is our guest today, Steve Osad. Steve's new book, Omar Nelson Bradley, America's G.I. General, is the subject of our show today, and in terms of its depth of research and understanding of this fascinating man, it is worth the read. Of course, Bradley is credited with doing much to improve the military healthcare system and with helping veterans receive their educational benefits under the G.I. Bill of Rights. Before we talk to Steve, let's listen to Bradley himself in this quote about the VA and helping shape it into the Veterans Administration support agency it is today.
And as a memory of heroic battles on sea, land, and in the air fade into history, we dare not close our eyes to the post-war problems of the men who won the war. We must provide intelligently and promptly for these young veterans if the nation is to provide profit for their return and if we are to move ahead toward a better world.
Please join me in welcoming to the show author Steve Osad. Stephen Osad, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Your Army history experience is well known. Your expertise is really very impressive, and I'm grateful for your being here, especially to talk about this new book. And I'd like to say right at the start that there are other books available on Omar Bradley. There's similar research on U.S. military history. There are other political stories kind of during these same time periods, but tell us your new and original take on Omar Bradley.
Thanks. I tried to look at Omar Bradley in the full context of his life, not only in his military career, where, frankly, I think he suffered by comparison to great men both above him, like Eisenhower and Montgomery, as well as at least one historically astounding subordinate, George Patton. So I think I brought a new perspective on the military history analysis because I tried to view Bradley in his various roles through the progression of the war, from his first arrival in North Africa in February of 1943, completely unknown, completely untested, through his experience as first a corps commander in both Africa and in the invasion of Sicily, and then as the U.S. First Army Commander, the man who led all Americans ashore on D-Day and the lodgment in the Normandy battle through the breakout, and then finally in his last assignment during the war as an Army Group Commander, one of only three Americans ever to hold that position, and the most important Army combat ground commander among the Allies, in the most important central front and wielding the most important power. So that was my perspective on evaluating the man as a general. And then I tried to look at the full story, who he was, what shaped his education, his background, his point of view, his experience at West Point and the people that he met there, and his wives, first Mary, his even before high school, Sweetheart. And then very, very late in life, Kitty, his second wife and a woman nearly 30 years his junior, who was with him through the end and who also played a role in how he's remembered, particularly in the movie Patton, where both Bradley and Kitty were military advisors and received hefty payments that established their fortune thereafter, as it was, as most people know, one of the most successful war movies ever made, and topped the revenue and gross lists for that year and established, I think, a record that lasted for some time. So that, I think, is the perspective that I tried to bring. And as you pointed out earlier, this is not exactly territory that's untrod. And like everyone else, I desperately searched for some kind of archival advantage or some sort of historical point of view that would make it stand out. And on that, I got lucky. I found another officer, a British officer, who had been assigned to Bradley's headquarters as Montgomery's personal liaison to Omar Bradley. And in his papers, his name was Thomas Bigland, I found letters, a diary, scrapbooks, and correspondence that had only been used once before in a major biography of Bernard Montgomery by the famous British historian Nigel Hamilton, who had used the material for a very specific purpose. But I was lucky, and I saw that Bigland had many observations and keen insight into the personalities and the situations that he was witness to. And I think that is a unique perspective, and I hope that readers, not only in the UK, but also in America, will appreciate Bigland and his role as a witness and also as a diarist in the campaign, and particularly as someone very, very close to Omar Bradley, who literally met him, talked to him every day.
Well, I know my audience will really appreciate your storytelling abilities, as well as just these kind of key nuggets that you've unearthed. I think my audience will also think about Omar Bradley as a true leader of men. Why, during this period of military conflict, kind of going back, kind of Joint Chiefs role and role with VA and kind of some of the non-conflict oriented activity of General Bradley, why do you think that being a leader of men was so important at that time?
I think that actually was a value that was instilled, and I think to some extent still is instilled in the West Point education itself. Although it's evolved considerably over the decades, over the century, really, since Bradley arrived in 1911, it was based on the concept of leadership and continual testing in classrooms, on athletic fields, on military exercises, in training, and so on. And one of the major manifestations of that is the cadet ranking system itself, which survives. Bradley, on that score, started out at a huge deficit. It turned out that during that period of time when he was considering applying to West Point, the rules changed and there was a need for more cadets. Bradley luckily was able to get into the academy, although the testing and so on was later than the normal routine, but he arrived on August 1st and was thereafter, like the others in that category, called an Augustine. It turned out that because they arrived nearly a month and a half after the others, including Eisenhower and a long list of cadets who achieved great prominence in World War II, in fact, it's that class is referred to as the class the stars fell on. And in ordinate, unbelievable percentage of the graduates won stars as general officers in World War II. But the Augustines were blighted from the very beginning, and they felt that they were discriminated against because they had missed some of the rites of passage, including what is still referred to as the beast barracks, a grueling, leveling experience for all incoming cadets, which bonded those who went through it. Bradley was on the outside, and he didn't achieve cadet rank until his fourth year, where he was rapidly promoted. So I think that drove him even harder in his subsequent assignments and throughout his career.
We are with Stephen Osad. Stephen Osad is a military army history expert, a member of the Army Historical Foundation, joining us today talking about his new book, Omar Nelson Bradley, America's GI General, which is out. I am going to put up links to this. I just think my audience will love this book, Stephen. But tell us, diving into this idea of his leadership style, tell us a little bit about one of the quotes that jumped out at me as I did my research on both you and General Bradley, and that had to do with his idea about overall motivation. He said, among many things, he said, education makes a people easy to lead, but difficult to drive, easy to govern, but impossible to enslave. I think that just says it so beautifully. Some of these quotes, they don't even really surface in many instances, but he really said this so well. We should all look to some of these quotes as being ways for us to lead and motivate and even think about humanity.
I think that's a very good point. Education, continuing professional education especially, was regarded by Bradley and the others as an absolute necessity for success, not something to be put aside. And the greatest of the men I've studied so far incorporated it throughout their lives, even focusing on specific engagements or specific figures that were inspirational. Bradley, for instance, was fascinated by the late-stage Civil War, the operations of Sherman in particular, and also Grant when they combined their forces into very, very large bodies of men. Almost what he was going to experience as an Army group commander after August of 1944, the operational art, it's called. But its roots were there again at the very beginning. Right after West Point, Bradley's first assignment was with an infantry regiment serving in Washington State. And there, by chance, he was roommates with another incredibly important officer and one of the great scholar warriors of the U.S. Army, a man named Edwin Harding. He later became one of the founders of the Army's doctrine at the infantry school and elsewhere that became the foundation for the establishment of the huge citizen soldier army of World War II. Circling back to your quote, the essence of a democratic army from the very beginning is that orders have to fit into context. And Americans, from the very beginning, from Valley Forge itself in the early drill masters, experience is full of examples of the necessity to put orders, doctrine, tactics into a framework that an American army can understand and follow. And I think that's also reflected in the educational requirements of the Army, and also in Bradley's experience as not only a student at the Army's various schools, but also an instructor. And that, too, was a factor of the interwar Army. All of the men who led major combat formations that became legends and common in the mass media of the time all had spent large periods of their careers as both instructors and teachers. And that too remains a factor and a part of the structure of our modern Army, and I think is also one of the great examples of what makes our Army unique and different.
Well, let's jump ahead to today and talk about our Army and leadership. What What can we learn about General Bradley's style of leadership and inspiration today?
Now, that's a very tough question. And I've always been skeptical of leadership lessons that come in a box because the details and the circumstances shape not only the man and his times, but also the concepts of leadership and the tools. But let's just take a quick look at how Bradley operated in the field, perhaps as a guide, still remembering that what we're talking about is someone who is at war every day, and that war ground on for 8 months, I believe. To draw lessons of leadership under those sorts of extreme circumstances, again, is only a guide. And I was fascinated by how he operated and how consistent it was. In essence, after awakening and doing his usual routine, he received his first briefing of the day at about 8:15, which included everything that had happened overnight, as well as a very brief update of the most secret information, so-called ultra information, carefully guarded. After that, he generally telephoned each of his principal commanders. During action, he actually visited those people face-to-face or sent key aides or top staff officers to do the same. That, I think, is crucial, particularly in our time where communication is so easy on so many levels, up to and including face-to-face encounters. I think that that cannot be understated, evaluating someone face-to-face, particularly in the middle of a crisis. Afterwards, he then went and made the visits in the field, or conferred with his officers on planning, or dealt with the mountain of paperwork that also accompanies being a general of an army in the field, received his last briefing late at night, also including the most secret information. That didn't vary much as he rose in command. The only glaring example of an exception, and perhaps this is a bit of a lesson, was during his greatest setback during World War II, the Battle of the Bulge, the costliest land engagement in American history, 19,000 dead over a full month, and a complete strategic surprise, which I examine in depth in the book, for which Bradley bears the main responsibility. And one of the main things that I discovered was during the campaign, he stopped doing what he had been doing. He stopped going and visiting men in the field, ostensibly because the weather was really bad, which is true. He didn't maintain tight control over his subordinate commanders, particularly the commander in the north, who was under the most pressure. And in general, abandoned the operating principles on which he had been conducting his war up until that point. And I'm not really sure even now why that happened or what led him to that complete change, but I think there's a message there. And that is, you don't give up tried and true methods and procedures and protocols, particularly when things get hot, no matter what's going on.
Fascinating. These anecdotes are really wonderful. Stephen Osad's been joining us. Stephen is the author of Omar Nelson Bradley, America's GI General. Stephen, I really appreciate your time. I really have one more question for you, and I want to talk today's kind of time frame, a little bit of history here, about Norman Schwarzkopf, who's been quoted as saying it doesn't take a hero, title of his book, and then maybe juxtapose that, compare that to a quote from Bradley saying, "Bravery is the capacity to perform properly, even when scared half to death." I love that quote. These are two different guys, and I wonder, different times, different leaders. How do you kind of compare the two, Schwarzkopf and Bradley, and their kind of positions in history?
First, let me say that both were, again, keenly aware of their heritage at West Point, what that meant, and their legacy as commanders. It doesn't take a hero is Schwarzkopf all the way, and I think it's actually the essence of the title of my book, The GI's General, the image of Omar Bradley as just an ordinary guy, not a dressed-up general, but a guy who wasn't going to gamble lives recklessly. And I think that Norman Schwarzkopf was in exactly the same type of, well, frame of mind, particularly in his greatest battle, which he envisioned from the very beginning as an encirclement battle in a long tradition, which would cost fewer lives in the end, although it would require huge kinetic force at the beginning. And I think that's what he delivered. The subsequent outcome was political, but the military victory was absolute. And the destruction of the Iraqi forces, including their most elite units, was total. We basically dictated terms on the battlefield to a conquered enemy. So that is a stunning revelation even in our lifetime when you consider it and the scale. But it's exactly the same achievement that Omar Bradley was able to play a major role in, delivering an unconditional surrender. That is a subject for another discussion, but I think both men would fully understand that kind of outcome is very unlikely in the future.
Well, Stephen Ossad, thanks for joining us today. I hope you'll accept my invitation for future discussions, because I can just tell this could go on for a while. I think my audience will love this. I personally enjoy this history. You're an expert, you're a writer, historian, technology analyst, all of these things. Importantly, your new book, Omar Nelson Bradley, America's GI General, is, I believe it's available for pre-order. Is that right, Steve?
That's right. It's available on the Amazon page.
Great. And where can my audience find out more information about you, Stephen Ossad?
You can check my website. Just look up Stephen L. Ossad. And I think that's probably the best access. Also LinkedIn and Facebook.
Well, we'll put links to all of those places. But Stephen Ossad, thank you so much for joining us today. Again, the book, Omar Nelson Bradley, America's GI General. Lots of great historical anecdotes and information, and just some very special stuff on what really was a very special person in our military history. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today on the Not All Better Show.
Thank you, Paul. Enjoyed it very much.
Thanks. Thanks to our guest today, Steve Ossad, in his new book, Omar Nelson Bradley, America's GI General. As usual, we'll post links to everything, including one of the chapters from Steve's book, and a link of where you can go to purchase the book on Amazon. But also, as usual, my thanks to you, the listeners, for joining me today. Your time is valuable, and I'm grateful you're spending some of it with me today. I'm always interested in feedback, and you can leave it at iTunes, Google Play, or send me an email at info@notold-better.com. info@notold-better.com. Stay tuned for our next show, another great one, as we talk about better. The Not Old Better Show. Thanks to all.